This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. This evening, we're coming to you from St. Peter's Church, North Main Street, Cork, at the conclusion of the National Civil War Conference held over the last 4 days at UCC. And a marvellous event that was. Now, this evening's topic is the assassination of Sir Henry Wilson and the Irish Civil War. On the 22nd of June 1922, Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, former Chief of the Imperial General Staff and Unionist MP for North Down, was assassinated outside his London home in Eaton Square. The anti-treaty IRA were blamed, and 6 days later, under pressure from the British, Michael Collins ordered the bombardment of the forecourts, the opening salvos of the Irish Civil War. But who was Henry Wilson? Was he, as was alleged, the mastermind behind the anti-Catholic pogroms in Belfast, 1920-22? And who ordered the hit? To address these and other questions, I'm joined by John Dorney, editor of the Irish Story website and author of The Irish Civil War in Dublin, The Fight for the Irish Capital, 1922-1924, published by Irish Academic Press in 2017. On my right, Caoimhe Nic David, senior lecturer in modern history at the University of Sheffield. And to my immediate right, Padraig O'Rourke, regular Hedge School panellist, author of Truce, Murder, Myth, and the Last Days of the Irish War of Independence, published by Mercer Press in 2016. And finally, on my far left, John Regan, who lectures in history at the University of Dundee. And this Hedge School is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012-2023 initiative. Okay, get us started. Before I start, guys, just for the audience, you are at a school, a Hedge School, so you have to sit up straight in your seats, pay attention and participate in the discussion. We have a radio mic here. It won't be just a Q&A at the end. So, you know, if you want to intervene at any stage, ask a question, disagree violently with something that's said from the podium here, do not hesitate. Just put your hand up, but make sure you use the mic so, because it's being recorded, and, you know, keep it clean. Now, to get us started, John Dorney, who was Henry Wilson? What's his background?
Well, Henry Wilson was, at one point in his career, towards the end of his career, the most senior officer in the British Army. He was the Commander-in-Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And from that, you know, the outrage of his assassination, which we'll get to in the end, comes. But his origins were in County Longford. He was a member of a landowning family, not of the largest landowning class, but significant landowners in County Longford. He referred to himself, though, as an Ulsterman, Tommy. His family roots were in County Antrim. Despite being landowners in Longford, he did refer to himself as an Ulsterman. His family were unionists, explicitly unionists in politics. So his father and his brother both ran as unionist MPs for County Longford in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, Longford is majority nationalist, majority Catholic county. The unionist votes just weren't there after the extension of the franchise, but both of them did very badly. But Wilson's identity is very much, you know, of an Irishman of a sort, but an imperial Irishman, if you like. Ireland as a part of the British Empire very strongly believes in this. Ulster is a subset of this identity, I think, for him. Like a lot of members of his class, who were younger sons particularly, who would not inherit the family lands, he goes and joins the British Army. He starts off with the Longford Militia, joins the cavalry, though despite the fact he was extremely tall, which usually would not make him an ideal cavalry man. He serves throughout the British Empire, so he serves first of all in Burma in the 1880s in a campaign against Dacoits, which are reported as bandits, wherever they saw themselves. He became a protege of Lord Roberts. Lord Roberts is a very important general in the British Army in the late 19th century, technically the chief of staff of the Indian Army, British Army in India. And in the South African War, Roberts is parachuted in to kind of sort out the ailing British war effort, and Wilson is part of that. And so he rises rapidly in the ranks, becomes a very senior kind of officer in the British Army, to the extent that in 1911, he's very important, actually, in the diplomatic efforts to forge an alliance between Britain and France, the Entente Cordiale, which leads to the First World War. So Wilson's an imperialist, both by service and by conviction, and by identity. He's, you know, an extremely high-ranking
He's at the heart of the whole British setup.
Absolutely. And in the First World War, I mean, you know, he's not a field commander. His role is to liaise with the French High Command, with General Foch, and even with Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister. Who he refers to by his nickname. He's so familiar with him.
No, it's interesting that he rose so quickly, because at the beginning it wasn't his career wasn't so great. Like, I mean, did he fail a few exams and stuff at the start?
Yeah, supposedly. He was a lazy student and stuff like this. But
so he failed the Leaving Cert here. You know, all is not lost, right? Now, he was involved in the Curragh Mutiny. Maybe before I go to you on this, right? What was his role in that?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, just to fill in a few other details on his personality, he's not at the very highest point of the ascendancy, but he does grow up in a 14-bed mansion, and the mansion actually gets electricity in the 1890s, so about 60 years before any of the workers who would have been working for him get it. The family were regarded as being pretty decent landlords. When he had been in Burma, as John mentioned, he was actually slashed in the face. It was kind of a guerrilla war that was going out, and one of the Burmese insurgents slashed him in the face with a dal, which is a knife for cutting, like a machete for cutting bamboo. So he's left with a permanent facial scar as a result of that. So the guy's not afraid, even though he's later in high office, he gets into the thick of fighting at stages. And he marries Cecilia Mary Ray. And he has a sense of humour about both his kind of really gangly height and his disfigurement. And he's happily refers to himself as being the ugliest man in the British Army, which is an achievement. He's a bit of a racist and a snob. Not unusual for a British Army officer at the time, but to give you a quote, in June of 1921, he writes to one of his friends, quote, "Persians are an absolutely rotten people, far more rotten than even the Poles or South Country Irish, and that puts them pretty low." So, now again, remember, racism is pretty standard at the time, and snobbery, but he, you know, as John said, he's an Irishman, but he's an Ulster man, and he sees himself as very different from the Southern Irish. He's also somewhat of a conspiracy theorist. When ideas come up about kind of in Irish independence, Bolshevism in Russia, Indian independence, anything like that, he sees it as being kind of organized by Central. But you asked me, Tommy, about the Curragh Mutiny.
People often don't answer the questions asked for us.
Yeah, I'm coming to it. I just had to fit the other points in. So the Curragh Mutiny, what happens is Home Rule, it's the third Home Rule Bill. The Irish have been looking for Home Rule, the majority of the Irish, for about 40 years. Finally, it's coming on the scene. It's been passed through the House of Commons. It's been delayed by the House of Lords for 2 years. It's due to come in 1914. First World War intercedes. But what happens in the meantime is, of course, the Ulster Volunteers arm against it. The Ulster Protestant Loyalists arm against it. They start importing guns from Germany, and basically it looks like civil war is about to break out over this issue of Home Rule. And the British Army officers in the Curragh, including Henry Wilson, the idea is floated that they may get an exemption from having to put down rebellion in Ulster. And they basically threaten a mutiny that they will not do this. And Henry Wilson is somebody who throughout his life has contempt for politicians. He sees the military men as being the core of the empire, and he refers to politicians derisively as, frocks. And it's worth talking about what Home Rule, just briefly to describe it. Home Rule was far less than independence than the Scottish Parliament has today. Home Rule did not give powers over taxation or any social issues. It didn't give Ireland its own army or a foreign policy. It's really a glorified county council. But even that measure of southern independence in Ireland, he is willing to risk conspiring with armed Ulster paramilitarism to prevent that happening. And they're the people who've been importing arms from Germany. And in 1908, Henry Wilson had actually been invited to London to brief the British government on what were the prospects of war with Germany. And now, effectively, he was willing to risk conspiring with the enemy and their allies in Ulster.
How central was he in that whole, you know, the mutiny? I mean, like, what was his position at that stage, right? Or was he just another one who refused to follow the order?
You see, again, it's a conspiracy. They don't keep minutes of the meetings. But my understanding is that he was kind of the liaising between different factions involved.
He was well connected, like, central, not just an individual.
Oh, no, he's not on the peripheries of it. Yeah, he's definitely, 100% behind it.
John Regan, of course, I've made the mistake of having two Johns in the panel, fatal in this game, when you're doing podcasts. John Regan, just let's get back to the Wilson as a British imperialist, right? Because I didn't hear too much about that this weekend, actually, right? You know, we were talking about the Civil War, right? I mean, is this something that's neglected in current historiography? You know,
that's a point really important to make, that one of the trends in modern Irish historiography has been to, in a sense, denude the imperial context of the Irish struggle and to focus within a particular style of or focus of writing on individual acts of violence, which is where we're actually starting off from today, in a sense. And I don't want to get into the story, but it's important to note that when Wilson is assassinated on his doorstep, what we're witnessing is, of course, an IRA assassination, but we're also witnessing two forces meeting, British imperialism and Irish republicanism. And that context, that imperial context, has sometimes been lost, where in the historiography, people have focused on singular acts of violence, which are described in great detail, but they're not explained that within Irish republicanism, there was a profound anti-imperialist agenda, which connected with insurrectionary nationalist liberation struggles around the world. And the IRA in 1920-21 are at the very forefront of that global struggle and are quite effective in effect. Wilson, as an imperialist, as Patrick said already, he has all the attributes of a British imperialist of his generation. He is a profound racist. He is anti-Semitic. He looks down upon subjugated peoples who he believes the British Empire owns. He's a racial superior.
Supremacist.
Yep. And there's nothing exceptional within the ruling class in the empire in any of these attributes. But it's well to be reminded that that's what the IRA are fighting against. They're looking for national self-determination against something which imperialism, which we might describe as a criminal conspiracy. Now, it's dressed up with honorifics, Lord this and Sir that, and uniforms and all the pomp and ceremony of institutions like the British Army and the monarchy and all the rest of it. And if you're on the winning side of that, that's a great thing to belong to, and you can, you know, further your life and your career and your wealth and all the rest of it. But if you're on the butt end of imperialism, it doesn't look so impressive. And what tipped in Ireland in the early 1900s was any acceptance any longer of belonging or participating in what is essentially an exploitative system.
Sorry, I just want, you know, you were setting the scene. You were setting the scene about Home Rule, and you were saying he was a glorified county council. Can you confirm that we were going to lose our 106 MP seats in Westminster?
The number of seats in Westminster was going to be reduced from 106 down to about 40. Okay. So there would be a parliament in Dublin, which, you know, looked very impressive, but it would have very little power. It wouldn't even control the postal service locally, and the real decision making would still be made back in Westminster. So, as I said, if you compare it to the Scottish Parliament today, which is by no means fully independent, Home Rule was far less a measure.
And that's important, because what the British want is the Irish out of Westminster, where they hold a balance of power.
No, I have a question about Henry Wilson, and he was referred to by, or the Army Mutiny was referred to by Eunuch O'Connor in one of his books as they were Europe's first fascists. Now, would the panel agree with going that far in it, Margaret?
I don't want to have a question, but I think the best you could say is, and I wouldn't be, there are certainly people who come later who are linked to the British Conservatives, like the British Fascisti, the very first British fascist group, who do organise in Ireland and have a lot of loyalists involved. Henry Wilson is obviously dead at that stage. I think the harshest you could be in them is saying they were proto-fascists, because fascism hadn't been invented at that stage.
Can I just come in there briefly, Tommy? Yeah. I mean, like you know, let's not kind of go too far. I mean, the likes of Wilson is an interesting character, and that whole thing about the Home Rule crisis is interesting from a British perspective as well, because what you have is the elements of the army and part of the Conservative Party who are in temporary opposition, you know, flirting with kind of armed insurrection because they see the Liberal Party as a revolutionary assembly. You know, it's a little bit reminiscent of some of the stuff you see in America today with the Republican Party. And Wilson and people like him, they're kind of contemptuous of politicians and they don't like them and stuff. But there's never a suggestion by Wilson that he's going to overthrow the government or anything like that, you know. It's a series of attitudes. It's not an ideology.
Is it a mutiny?
They don't actually mutiny, but they make it known that they might refuse to follow the orders that would be issued. And so then in order to avoid that military crisis or what would be, a kind of constitutional crisis where you have senior army officers refusing to obey lawful orders, they decide not to issue the orders, right? And they make known that senior officers in the Curragh would not be called upon to disarm or to arrest Ulster Unionists. So, you know, I don't think I would describe them as fascist because I think fascism is a sort of it's a well-theorized ideology that is very specific in its, you know, it has things around militarized masculinity. It has ideas around, you know, highly conservative ideology towards women and the church and the organization of society. So where we can see overlap in personnel, as Padraig, you were talking about, I think it's going a bit too far to describe them as fascist.
I want to move on to the War of Independence Cuba. Yeah, right? Yeah. So what was Wilson's role in that?
Well, he's chief of the Imperial General Staff, right? So his, you know, that's a wide-ranging brief, as the title suggests. He is, and this is, you know, we didn't really touch too much on his role during the Great War. I mean, John, you talked about his close relationship with Foch and Clemenceau, and his he's awarded the title Field Marshal in recognition of his contribution during the Great War, and it was quite an unusual honour for him to get because he wasn't a great commanding general in the field.
He's a desk man.
He's a desk man.
Yeah. Like Michael Collins.
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah. But, you know, has a very clear strategic brain. Apparently was, he kind of masterminded, you know, the British Expeditionary Force and forged this close relationship with Foch, who was the other marshal. And they were sort of a comical pair because Wilson was so tall and gangly and Foch was tiny. So they were sort of little and large. And they were sort of caricatured, I guess. But you know, so he's been involved in the Great War, overseeing all of that. He was a brilliant lecturer, apparently, at Sandhurst, you know, a compelling speaker and a very able military strategic thinker and a tactician. And of course, as we know, you know, the war in the Great War is not just in the European theatre, right? It extends into it extends into Palestine. It brings in, you know, the former territories of the Ottoman Empire. There's concerns about what's happening in Russia in 1917, and Wilson is kind of involved in all of that as well. So his brief is very wide, and the demobilization of all those troops during the Great War, that occupies a lot of his day-to-day matters. But because he's so obsessed with Ireland as being the kind of linchpin of the empire, and if Ireland falls, the empire then will fall. And because he's an Irishman, an Imperial Irishman, as we've put it, he interests himself in Irish affairs continuously. And he, you know, has strong opinions. We've talked about how he is contemptuous of politicians. And he's, you know, doubly contemptuous of liberal politicians. Don't forget, during the War of Independence, it's a coalition government. So Lord George is the Liberal Prime Minister, but he is in cabinet with some conservative politicians, heavyweights, big beasts. And part of the problem for that government is that there's a lot of pressure from the conservative backbenchers who want them to take a stronger line to deal with the murder gang of the IRA, as Wilson is wont to put it. So Wilson is a voice that is constantly pushing the cabinet, as kind of senior military advisor to the cabinet, to use military methods to deal with the insurrection in Ireland. And that's kind of that's a key distinction. You know, how do you deal with this insurrection? Lloyd George wants to treat it as a policing problem. Therefore, you have to deal, it's the police who should deal with it. This is not a war. This is anarchy by, you know, using terror tactics by a bunch of, you know, corner boys who don't have the support of the population. This is the kind of gloss that Lloyd George is putting on it, and although that, you know, that is clearly not the case. But Lloyd George is reluctant then to send to give the army, to let them off the leash. And that's why then you have kind of halfway houses like the Black and Tans, who Wilson is also critical of, because he sees them as sort of just adding to the chaos and the anarchy. And he wants hard military measures to go in and restore order. He's a law and order man.
John Regan, maybe just come back on that point, because he was critical of the Black and Tans and their excesses, right, to be fair to him, right? But can you put that in context?
He has a very particular idea about law and order. So when the auxiliaries are sent over and the Black and Tans are sent over, although he wants to use the army and force, he's not happy about going outside of the law to put down the insurrection. So he has this conversation with Churchill in September 1920, and there are reports of assassinations of Shinners coming back. And Churchill's delighted. He thinks this is a great idea. Wilson doesn't like this at all. He doesn't like the state behaving illegally, whereas Lloyd George and Churchill are quite happy to see the function of law and order actually abandoned for the greater political goal of suppressing the Sinn Féin IRA rebellion. Just going back briefly to the Curragh crisis, that's crisis where the officer corps circumscribes British policy there forward. It limits what the British can do in Ireland.
John, you want to come in?
Yeah, just on the War of Independence and the Black and Tans and Wilson. So, like, sometimes you'll see it written and stuff that Wilson is, you know, a good guy, basically, because he's against the Black and Tans, right? But it's, you know, he's against the Black and Tans in a way because, like John says, it's half measures, right? What he really wants is martial law, which means that military rule in all of Ireland, you know, so it'll be perfectly legal to execute as many people as you want every month. And Wilson is like, you can shoot, if it needs to be shooting 100, that's fine. If you need to kill Michael Collins and 50 of his best men, that's what you do. You know, you arrest them and then you shoot them by firing squad, which is what you do in the Empire, you know. So it's a question of, but it's interesting because it shows Wilson's whole worldview. He's a military man, believes in discipline and hierarchy and order. But it's not a humanitarian impulse, right? It's like he doesn't like the disorder.
But Ireland was an integral part of the United Kingdom, right?
Not anymore. The British are leaving.
Yeah, but my point being that I'm assuming then that Wilson takes that seriously. In other words, he sees himself as part of a single United Kingdom, so he's opposed to kind of illegality.
Not necessarily, no. Right. I mean, it's a question of order and hierarchy, right? So, like, I mean, he says that, like, you can declare martial law, you can rule it effectively as a colony, like the legal term is a crown colony, which they never quite do. And it's like, this is what you would do in an insurrection, you know, in South Africa or wherever else, right, in the Empire. You would just shoot as many people as you needed to, no problem. But you do it within the hierarchy of the army, you know.
Right.
That's Wilson's worldview. It's not that he's concerned about, you know, humanity.
Which you made in the review of the Ron McGreevy's book recently. By the way, Ron McGreevy was invited to be on the panel here, but unfortunately he couldn't be here because of a family event. No, but you made the point that Wilson doesn't recognise the colonial context. In other words, that Churchill and Lloyd George are thinking like that.
The War of Independence is a funny war. The British are leaving Ireland in some shape or form. They're going. So the Republicans and the IRA are, to some extent, pushing at an open door. What Wilson wants is that door to be closed completely, but the British are leaving. The government know that there's going to be some kind of compromise down the line. So rather than conventional colonial war, what the British government are fighting is a holding action. And I've spoken about this before. What they're holding up against is the idea that there will be some kind of renegotiation with Ireland. But what they don't want in the interim is Ireland to be a cockpit of revolution. You have hundreds and thousands of soldiers returning. You have insurrection. You have Europe, Germany in flames, Germany on the cusp of revolution. They're sending tanks to Glasgow, to Red Clydeside to put down labour unrest there. So if the thing gets out of order in Ireland and you use massive repression, you will destabilise the island of Ireland, Irish communities in Glasgow and Liverpool and London, and maybe the entire Irish community in Great Britain. So it's a very particular kind of war that they're fighting.
Wilson's against home rule.
Block home rule, and that's why he's doing what he's doing with the current mutiny, because he is, you know, in back channel talks with Ulster Unionists and with other senior officers to try and block home rule. And at that point, you know, this is before the Easter Rising, this is before the war, shelves home rule for a little while. We can hear what the other panelists think, but the aim is to block home rule for the whole of Ireland. It's not necessarily to keep home rule, to have partition for Ulster, keep Ulster in the Union, Southern Ireland can do what they want. That's not the point that they're at yet. It's to block Home Rule for the entirety of Ireland.
He sees Home Rule as the first domino to fall in the empire. If we lose Ireland today, we'll lose India tomorrow, and so it will go on and on. And that's why he's so animated about the issue.
Can I intervene here? This reminds me of the remark when Deb went over the preliminary discussions with Lloyd George, and somebody said, "How far have you got?" And the answer was the Confederation of Kilkenny. I want to move on from this.
Because the thing about Henry Wilson is like he is so frustrated with the government that they have in England because he thinks that they're surrendering with this Home Rule thing. You know, he thinks this is a terrible thing. And so, like, he's the chief of the Imperial General Staff, but he hates what they're doing. You know, he thinks, like, on the one hand, they're giving too much with Home Rule. On the other hand, they're making the British Empire look bad with these half measures to black and tans when he should just send in the army. You know, he's kind of a reactionary conservative, his position, you know.
Okay, now, the thing is that the War of Independence comes to an end with the truce. In July 1921, okay? And, I mean, this assassination, you know, technically is a violation of that truce, but there's truces. Just talk to us about that, because that's your area of study.
Well, in the South, the truce pretty much holds. It's a different situation in the North. And, I mean, remember, Henry Wilson refers to himself as an Irishman and an Ulsterman, and his family roots are in Ulster. And what you have is that the day the ceasefire is announced is the bloodiest day in Belfast history. About 22 people are killed in 24 hours in rioting on the 11th of July 1921. Now, to put that in a modern context, that's more than the Bloody Friday bombings. That's more than the Ballymurphy massacre. And the IRA leader, one of the IRA leaders in Antrim, Thomas Fitzpatrick, says the truce was not observed by either side in the north. And the situation up there is totally different to the situation that most of us, having learned our local history here in the south, would be familiar with. You're talking about a very large, dominant loyalist population who are armed. They have armed themselves in the UVF. We talked earlier about Henry Wilson and them. And the UVF at this stage is taking a backseat to the Special Constabulary, who've been armed by the British government up to the point of the truce. But even though they had been stood down, most of them still had their arms. The IRA were very weak in the north, particularly in Belfast. And the Home Rule Party and their kind of some of them actually took up arms, and let's say the Ancient Order of Hibernians and people are involved in rioting. And what you get is between the truce and the treaty being signed, you have 60 deaths all over Ireland. About 40 of those are in Ulster, mostly in Belfast. Between 1920 and 1922, you have 498 deaths in the north. And there's an excellent article, if I can plug John's website, by Kieran Glennon on the Irish story that gives a breakdown. We won't go into all that now, but just to give you context, 500 people killed in the north in 2 years. That's about the same as were killed in Cork throughout the entirety of the War of Independence, the Civil War. And even though Catholics are a minority, they account for the majority of the fatalities. There's, you know, riots, there's expulsions from the shipyards, not just of Catholics, but think of Henry Wilson's mindset of rotten prods, Protestant socialists, Protestant Republicans, Labour activists, they're being kicked out as well. You have the infamous Nixon murder gang, the RIC, later RUC. They kill, the most probably infamous example is the McMahon family, who are home rulers, who are not Republicans. John McMahon is a publican, and himself, four of his sons, and one of their lodgers are executed in their family home by members of the RIC. You also, of course, have armed riots and attacks by Catholic nationalists in loyalist areas and vice versa, and a lot of sectarian killings. And remember, the IRA at the time in the north is very small. When the divide over the treaty comes, many of them join the Free State Army in the south rather than joining the anti-treaty side. And it's worth remembering as well why all this is relevant is when the assassins, which we've mentioned a few times, when they finally do speak and give their one of the explanations in court, they mention Wilson as having been involved in this. They say that he inspired, quote, the Orange Terror. Now, that may not be quite accurate, but that was the impression they had.
Now, John Dorney, right? This sort of terror campaign is the best way to describe it in the north, right? Particularly in Belfast. I mean, Wilson is often accused of being the sort of architect or the mastermind behind this. Like, I mean, is that true? I mean, is there any basis to that?
No, to be honest, there isn't. Wilson, as I hope I've outlined, is a hardline imperial unionist, right?
Yeah.
So he believes in the unity of the British Empire. He hates Home Rule. He wants a military solution. But he's not behind the, you know, the violence that goes on in Belfast. So what happens is, I mean, first of all, Wilson is the imperial chief of the imperial general staff. He's increasingly bad relationship with Lloyd George and with Winston Churchill. He hated the truce of July 1921. He said, we were just getting on top of the rebels and then they surrendered. So shortly afterwards, he goes into retirement and he is elected for North Down as an MP, unionist MP, and he becomes the military advisor of the Northern Ireland government. Now, you can hold it, now you can say, yes, he you know, in that capacity, he bears responsibility for what the forces
were. I was going to ask you, why would that impression have been created?
Because you have the Ulster Special Constabulary, you know, known to us now as the B Specials, and they're heavily involved in many killings that go on in the North. Now, it's somewhat of a two-way street. It's not totally one-sided in the North, but like, Catholics are certainly disproportionately killed, and a lot of them are done by the police, you know, like the McMahon killings and the, you know, and other incidents, the Iron Street killings. Now, Wilson's position as the military advisor, you can argue he bears responsibility for what the armed forces of Northern Ireland do, but his position is the same as the black and tan position, right? He hates disorder, right? But he wants this, you know, he says, you know, this is a job for the army, and the army should be brought in, not these kind of paramilitary type guys. So it's actually, it's against his ideas of order and hierarchy.
Associated very much with the Special Powers Act, which is enacted by the Northern Ireland Parliament in the spring of 1922. Although it seems he didn't write it, but he's associated in the public mind with it. And when that Special Powers Act is published, the text of the bill is published and then enacted, you know, he's denounced by everyone from Michael Collins to the editor of the Freeman's Journal. You know, he's described as a violent orange partisan. So he's associated in the popular mind with these, you know, the excesses of the kind of security state that is developed in Northern Ireland. But I guess there's a way in which we can see that the formalization of these exclusionary and aggressive security measures via the Special Powers Act is in line with his thinking about order. So this, I mean, the text of the Special Powers Act is worth reading, and it remained in force until 1971, I think, 69 or 71. And it is an outrageous assault on civil liberties, which becomes heavily weighted towards targeting nationalists. But there's and it allows for internment. It allows for, you know, arrests if you're found with seditious documents, which could be journals, which could be magazines, which could be any kind of Republican press. It prohibits gatherings of any more than, I mean, we're kind of used to it being prohibited with gatherings, you know, coming out of COVID, but this was extraordinary at the time. And it allows for flogging. And this in particular was viewed as a kind of humiliating aspect to that in that act. And that you can see that is coming from a kind of colonial context where flogging was used in India. But that is associated with Wilson, this idea that this act is targeting, is humiliating, and is, you know, endangering Northern nationalists. And that's fused in the popular mind, I think. And that
no, that's a very good point. But just very quickly, though, like that, I agree with you. That's a very good point. But the things that go on before the Special Powers Act comes in, like the McMahon murders, the Iron Street killings, are not actually Wilson's doing.
No, I agree.
So when does he become an advisor to the Northern Ireland government?
January 22.
Okay, so in the period from the treaty until the outbreak of the Civil War, he's until his own assassination, and he is
we don't know really what he's doing. I would agree that the Special Powers Act has the stamp of his mentality on it.
Yeah.
But he didn't have a monopoly on that mentality in Unionist Ulster. So it's very hard to get a fix. As far as I'm concerned, unless you guys know different, it's very hard to get a fix on him.
It seems to me then he's like a propaganda bogey, in a sense, you know, violent.
Well, the Freeman's Journal fixes on him as being an orange bogey. We had a presentation on cartoons. We had excellent examples of Wilson being exactly what you say,
right,
the orange bogey.
Right. Okay, now I want to just move on to the assassination itself, right? And this is the excellent the Examiner supplement for the conference, right? And this is dated June 11, 1922, and these are excerpts from newspapers at the time, right? It just starts off here. Remarks attributed to Michael Collins in an interview with New York's Herald newspaper are prepared for publication. On the recent shelling of Pettigo and of neighbouring Beleek, he says, quote, this is Collins, "By whomsoever ordered, they are carrying out the policy of Sir Henry Wilson and other prominent advisers of Sir James Craig, who avowedly want to destroy the position created by the treaty, to pave the way for the return of British troops and the ultimate reconquest of Ireland." Now, just to put this in context, right, Pettigo, Beleek,
my neighbourhood. I'm from Ballyshannon. This was a little piece of Fermanagh which wasn't accessible overland. You had to go to the Free State, you know, to get to it. And it was kind of low-hanging fruit, if you like, from the southern side. But it was occupied by a combined pro- and anti-treaty force for about 2 weeks. And they were eventually expelled by regular British troops using artillery. Now, John Regan, I just want to come to you, right, because this is the immediate context here, and this is, you know, the Northern Offensive, right, that which is a bit of a ghost of a thing. Right? Margaret O'Callaghan has been at her last Hedge School, for example, keeps saying she can't get anyone to explain to her exactly what is this Northern Offensive, right? So can you answer that question?
The Northern Offensive is organised by the IRB, and it opens a front against the North for various reasons. Unity in the South between the anti- and pro-treaty forces. So Collins and the Liam Lynch, they move troops and arms to the border with the prospect of staging some kind of invasion. The anti-treatyites are committed to this, as indeed are the Northern IRA. Collins is much more...
This is a violation of the treaty, though, presumably, and the truce, you know.
It's all over the shop.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's everything has been thrown up in the air.
Is it serious? Is it real? Or is this just a ruse to keep the anti-treaty people on side?
From Collins's point of view, that's what it turns out to be. It's very hard to read.
Yeah.
You know, he's taking enormous risks. He's taking weapons from the British. He's getting his fellas to chisel the code numbers, the registration numbers off the rifles and machine guns, whatever. Swapping those weapons with the anti-treatyites. Sending the untraceable weapons to the border, courtesy of people like Johnny Hahey and others. And they're building up arms and things and so forth. When the thing goes off, it goes off at half cock. You know, there are raids in Belfast. It's early May. It's a very un-Collins military operation. Aitken's 4th Division stands aside. They don't go into action, possibly because he's reading that Collins isn't committed to this.
Hmm.
And the whole thing is mopped up very quickly. But during that period, Collins wins over through patronage, money and arms and promises. The IRA, who are largely neutral in the North, or anti-treaty, some of them. A lot of those people are won over to the pro-treaty side. And the upshot of this exercise is that the Northern question is kind of neutralised, and the Northern IRA are neutralised, and then it's getting on with the business in the South.
But just to go back to the Baleek Pettigo affair, Wilson makes a public statement where he calls for Britain to reconquer Ireland. So that's what...
Okay.
That is kind of a crucial part of the background picture. There's a really interesting document in the National Archives in Kew, which is drawn up while the treaty is being negotiated, and it's contingency plans for if the talks break down and there's a resumption of hostilities. And... you know, I suspect this is kind of Wilson's vision for what a reconquest of Ireland would be, and it is terrifying. It is, you know, martial law across the whole country. It's mass internment. It's completely prohibiting the movement of people between Ireland and Britain, which, you know, as part of the United Kingdom, that would have been extraordinary. Although we are used to that now after COVID, but anyway, there you go. And so that statement that Wilson gives, where he calls for the reconquest of Ireland, that is throwing fuel onto a smouldering fire. And so then when the IRA, that joint force, occupy Baleek and Pettigo, Churchill is furious because he thinks we need to stamp this out quickly in once and for all, so that the Free State know they cannot try and take back Northern Ireland by force. And so that's why he sends, you know, it's a massive British force that are sent in with heavy artillery. They take it back pretty easily, and they remain in that part of Donegal for a year. They stay, yeah.
Well, Baleek is in Fermanagh, right? But the battery, this
they remain
fort,
in occupation for a long
my
time.
My milkman used to talk about this when I was a child, right? But that's actually in Free State territory. That was occupied from 1924. Yeah. Pettigo till 1923, right? Mm-hmm. I tell you what, John Regan, I want to move on to the assassination itself, right? And I want to talk about the two assassins, right? Dunn and O'Sullivan. Maybe, Porrick, if you could talk to us about that.
Yeah.
Because it's this was described earlier by Fergal McGarry as a diasporic response, which is an interesting way to describe an assassination, right?
Will I give an overview of who the two were?
Okay. Who were they, right?
So, Reginald Dunne is second generation London Irish parents. His dad is a British Army soldier. He's actually born in Woolwich Barracks, and he's an only child. And he's very much an intellectual. He's huge into books. He's very well read compared to his contemporaries. And he's very moralistic, very spiritual. He's particularly interested in Catholic theology. And one of his favourite works to read is John Henry Newman. He attends St. Ignatius College. He's there at the same time as the film director, Alfred Hitchcock, who's a brilliant film director, but a terrible human being for reasons we don't have time to go into here. He's Dunne is a classically trained violinist, and he's brilliant at playing the violin. And one day he's on his way home, and he hears traditional Irish music coming from a ceilidh that's being held by the Stamford Hill Conradh na Gaeilge, so the Irish language Gaelic revival organisation, and this enthralls him. And he falls in love with Irish music and the Irish language. And this is kind of an awakening for him. And it's interesting if you read about, let's say, lots of the Protestant Republicans who fought in the 1916 Rising in Dublin, most of them encountered a political change in their lives because of their involvement with Conradh na Gaeilge and the Irish language. But he joins the British Army anyway in September 1916. Now, he joins 3 months before his 18th birthday. Think about the timing. It's just after the Rising. It's just before his 18th birthday. Joining after the Rising is kind of strange for a guy who becomes the leader of the IRA in London, but he's probably joining because at that stage he's not quite Republican. He believes in the idea of if we fight and we win the war, we'll get payback with home rule. The other thing is, because he's London born, he's likely to be conscripted by his 18th birthday. And if he's conscripted, he'll be told, you're going into that regiment. Yeah. But he gets to pick an Irish regiment by volunteering. Anyway, he's wounded in the German Spring Offensive of 1918. His knee is shattered, and this is relevant later. In September 1919, he joins the IRA, drops out of teacher training, which is what he'd done, and becomes head of the IRA. He's involved in things in London like Cathal Brua, and Rory O'Connor is the Cathal Brua's Minister of Defence. Rory O'Connor is the officer commanding of IRA operations in Britain. And they're doing things like talking about assassinating members of the British cabinet if conscription comes in, for example, or gun smuggling. They're making contacts with things like with people like other radicals in London, like the emissaries of the Soviet Union, like British communists, Indian nationalists, Burmese nationalists, and they execute. They're involved.
Sounds like Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, they're involved in things like executing a spy who's fled from Dublin, Vincent Fugarve. And I'll talk about the other guy, O'Sullivan, briefly in a minute. But what strikes me as different between them is that this guy Dunne seems to have joined the IRA because he talks about the failure of he went and he fought in the war for the freedom of small nations, and he didn't get that. And he is very much, in his last letter, is very much religious, and the other guy, O'Sullivan, is more political. And that probably reflects their backgrounds, because O'Sullivan's parents were both actually born in Cork and then moved to London. O'Sullivan's from a very large working-class family, 11 children. His father's a tailor. He's also interested in home rule politics and trade unionism. Now, he joins before the Rising, 1915. He's initially in a London regiment and then later transfers to the Munster Fusiliers. At Passchendaele, he loses a leg. After he gets home, he gets a job in the Ministry of Labour and he joins the IRA. He's involved in burning the family homes of auxiliaries and black and tans. The IRA get information as where these guys live, and they go, well, if they're going to burn our people's houses in Ireland, we'll burn their people's houses in London, and there'll be less recruits. His family home in London, the O'Sullivan family home, is used as an IRA meeting place, and it is, you know, again, his last letter is very much framed. He's kind of steeped in republicanism at that stage. He's not even so much writing for his family as he knows this is going to be printed in the newspaper, and it's all about I die happy, I'm dying for Ireland, etc.
Now, okay, so these are bona fide IRA guys.
Yeah.
I mean,
having been in the British Army, I mean, yeah, I think that's quite interesting. Yeah. That's quite an interesting diasporic story.
But they're not peripheral people. These are hardcore, you know, high up the ranks of the IRA's organization, right? Deeply involved in you know, revolutionary activity in London, right? Now, what I'm getting at is the perennial question, like, who ordered this, right? I mean, because the anti-treaty IRA were blamed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the speculation that Collins may have ordered. Now, if it was Collins, right? Going back to that quote that I just gave earlier. Could this be seen as a defence of the treaty I know it led to the Civil War, but I mean, in other words, that they're taking out somebody that they see as an enemy of the treaty, because Wilson has gone public numerous times that he's against the treaty, wants a reconquest of Ireland or whatever. In other words, it's like, is this a protection of the treaty?
I probably should finish this just to describe for anyone who's not familiar with the assassination. These two guys, Henry Wilson, it's announced, is going unveiling a Great War memorial in Liverpool Street Station in London. And he unveils that, and then he's heading, because he's an MP, he's heading for the House of Commons afterwards. He unveils it, makes the speech in his British Army Field Marshal uniform. He's not going to wear that into the House of Commons, so he goes home to change. And when he goes home to change, these two guys, Dunn and O'Sullivan, are waiting for him. And as he's mounting the steps to his house at 36 Eaton Place, O'Sullivan comes up and fires. He seems to miss with his two shots, but Dunn has already run for the doorway and he shoots three times, and he's the person who fatally wounds, it appears, Marshal Wilson. But the question is, as you asked, Tommy, I should have just filled that in, the question is, who ordered it? Why?
Yeah. Before he ordered it, sorry,
did anyone order it?
Just briefly on the treaty thing, though, just be a second. So the thing is, you know, that makes sense if Wilson is still an important guy by that point, right? But he's not.
Okay.
You know, he's totally on the wrong side of the British establishment. You know, they hate him and he hates them. You know, like he's a reactionary, he's a dinosaur. He's against the treaty, which they're determined to make work. And if you look at the contrast between, for example, Wilson and the guy who's actually in charge of the British Armed Forces in Ireland, Macready, like, it's night and day. You know, those two guys were close personally, or at least they're, you know, on speaking terms. But, like, Macready is like, you must make the treaty work at all costs, whereas Wilson is this thing turned back the clock, which everybody knows is not possible.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, let's look at three scenarios, right? You know, anti-treaty IRA ordered it, Michael Collins ordered it, or nobody ordered it. So
yeah, or maybe a middle ground scenario, which is, it was an old order. It was an order issued maybe a year or so ago by somebody like Collins. But there's another kind of crucial event which happens in the run-up to the assassination, which is, so the London IRA and the London Republican movement, like others, are also divided about the treaty. And the London Common Amman women are very anti-treaty. And they're quite suspicious of somebody like Dunn and O'Sullivan. And Dunn goes over to Dublin and is in touch with Collins. And there's kind of suspicion. They're suspicious, you know, why are you going over dealing with these Free Staters? And Dunn is sent white feathers by London Cumann na Mban women. And everyone knows what a white feather means. That's a symbol of cowardice. What did that mean for somebody who had served in the Great War, who had his knee blown up? And there's a heated meetings for the London IRA in the week leading up to the assassination. They meet in a pub in Holborn. There's a lot of tension at that meeting. What are you going to? Why aren't you going to do something? When are you going to do something? Why don't you do something about take a side in this conflict that's emerging? And at that meeting, Dunn says, "I'm going to do something. I'm going to do something. You see, you watch and you see what I'm going to do." And then it's the next day. I mean, this is detailed from Ronan McGreevy's book. It's the next day then that they assassinate Wilson. And kind of the serendipity is the wrong word, but you know, the chance of his engagement being made public, that he's going to be at this place at this time, right. He'll be going back to his home. That's unusual. So they, you know, there's an element of opportunism that's part of it. My view is that it's an old order that is kind of activated again, but I'm open to be convinced.
There have been orders, like way back as far as 19, to assassinate members of British cabinet, but were they cancelled, were they not? I think there's a very, I'm not so sure was ordered, but I would agree largely with what Cuiva said. If you look, there had been a member of parliament assassinated, I think exactly a month earlier in Belfast, and that was William Twaddle, and he was the Ulster Unionist MP for West Belfast, and he was assassinated on Garfield Street in Belfast. Now, the guy who shot him was Seamus Woods, and he was the leader of the IRA in Belfast, but he had taken the pro-treaty side. And the IRA in Belfast was starting to fracture and starting to row over the issue of the treaty. And a lot of them were coming down south, but others weren't. And he seems to have shot and assassinated this MP in an attempt to unite the IRA in Belfast. And I think that is what Dunn and O'Sullivan are doing. Whether it had been ordered before, Doesn't mean that order is standing at the time. I think it's an attempt by them, guys who've been accused of cowardice, guys who don't want to see their comrades split. And this is actually the reason they give. They give three reasons why they did it in when their trial comes up. They say, again, the thing about fighting for the freedom of small nations. That's to try and engender some sympathy from the British public and the wider world. They talk about Wilson and the Orange Terror in the north. And then finally, he says that we, and it's largely Dunn that does the talking in court and reads out their statement, he said he wanted the assassination to cause the British to cancel the treaty and to restart the fighting with the IRA. And I think it's a solo operation by them. And it almost works. When it comes to the forecourts, yeah, the British at one stage are ordering it.
Yeah.
It doesn't come off that way, but I think it's two guys who are desperate, who would rather fight the British than fight amongst their comrades, and I think that's why they did it.
John Regan?
Well, it's a field marshal, it's a general. These guys are soldiers. They're committed IRA men. It could be a wildcat operation, as you suggest. There's no empirical solution to this. There's no letter, there's no document. So we can't do that. We can only offer a rational interpretation or argument in attempting to address the question of why he was killed. Dunn and Sullivan, they visit Dublin in early June. And that's the moment I think we need to focus on. The political situation in early June, not post-election, in around the 22nd of June. And the border is an issue then. They visit Collins, and they spend a lot of time with Collins, but there's also evidence that they meet with Rory O'Connor,
but they could have been visiting Collins for other reasons.
Any number of reasons.
Okay, let's move on to the anti-treaty IRA, the four-course people, right? Like, what's any smoking guns there? Excuse them.
From Collins's point of view, taking out Wilson, maybe, as you say, it may be useful for protecting the treaty, but he knows he's going to have the wrath of God coming down on him afterwards. For the other side, there is no other side in one aspect, which is the Northern policy. We've already talked about the joint Northern policy. That holds. The campaign has collapsed, but in terms of its operation, theoretically, they're still cooperating. And theoretically, we might look at the Wilson assassination in the context of the joint Northern operation. So the order may have been given in the context of that, and also with the function of placating the Northern IRA, that we're going to overturn the North, and as part of that policy, we're going to take out Wilson. That seems to me quite logical.
Yeah, but what about, just going back to the anti-treaty IRA, right? Like, why would they carry out such an operation?
Well, there, I mean,
they want the British to attack.
They want to escalate the situation.
It's a Q Bono situation. I'm trying to work out here. So they would have an interest in provoking the British into a response.
In the days before the 28th, they are amassing materials in the city of Dublin, cars, lorries and stuff. All that's going to the forecourts, massive amounts of petrol, and you've got people on the border reconnoitering it. They're going to have a second go at the north.
Right.
That's what they're planning.
Can I get in there, Tommy, though?
Yeah.
Just on that, though, on the anti-treaty thing, it's that John's right there, but the thing is that there's a bit more to it, right, which is that there's also a split in the anti-treaty IRA at this point.
Yeah.
Right? So the four-course people occupied that to try to, you know, destabilize the treaty and everything like that. But they disagree with, like, Liam Lynch, who's representing the southern divisions of the IRA and the anti-treaty side, who's the chief of staff. And just after this election in June, where the pro-treaty get the most votes, they have to decide what they're going to do now. So the faction in the four-courts is an extremist faction. They say they have this thing, they're going to declare war on Britain, and they drive down to Portobello Barracks and they deliver it to Richard Mulcahy, and they inform Britain they're going to declare war on them, whether it's going to be in the north, the six counties, as they say, whether it's going to be in Britain. And the intention is to provoke a response, you know, as John said. But the thing is that this is only a faction of the anti-treaty IRA. Now, Liam Lynch is not on board with this, right? The other thing, though, about Collins, and just like why he would do it, you know, possibly as part of this thing to reunite the IRA, although it seems exceptionally risky, given that he's dependent on British aid, you know, by this point to make the treaty work.
It might not be as risky as you think.
Okay, hold up. One sec, though, right? But the other thing is, like, did he do it, though, is the other question, regardless? Because Collins did all kinds of risky stuff, you know?
Hmm.
And the thing is, there's lots of circumstantial evidence. Like, people very close to Collins, like Frank Thornton, who's an intelligence officer, Tom Cullen, Joe Dolan, they say, yeah, Collins did it. We think it's Collins. And Joe Dolan, who's one of his intelligence officers, who's linked to the squad, you know, his GHQ Active Service Unit is what it's called, are sent over to London to try to rescue the guys before they're hanged.
Right? And this does suggest that Colin's fingerprints are somewhere around it.
It suggests IRB. And the confusion is that the IRB in the run-up to the 28th of June are not split. The IRA, as you correctly identify, are split.
Mm.
But anomalously, on the 27th, the First Southern and the Four Courts people look as if they're getting back together
again.
But that's kind of irrelevant. The Northern gig is an IRB gig, and they're working in tandem on that issue.
Can I just throw in one thing here? If it was ordered by Collins, right, this may be a conspiracy theory too far, right, was it a deliberate provocateur operation? I mean, is that a legitimate speculation to make?
It's just impossible to know, though. I mean, I just can't say. You know, that's all I know about it. You know,
no, but okay. Let's just wind this back again, though. In terms of the occupiers, the Four Courts, right? Whichever faction, right?
Mm.
I mean, the point is they're blamed for it.
Yeah.
That's how. But they are blamed for it. We know that for definite. Because so this leads on to my final question, right? Final discussion, because it won't be one question, not with you guys and this audience, right? Is Was this a trigger for the Civil War? Was it the trigger for the Civil War?
Like, it's the short-term trigger, absolutely. Because what the British government says, we have the letter from Lloyd George to the provisional government. And what it says is, you know, this faction in the Four Courts have said they're going to declare war on us. They're just sending people to the six counties, they use those terms, and they've killed Wilson, you know, and they assume it's them. You have to remove them for the Four Courts, or we'll do it. We have the troops in Dublin, we're going to do it. And you know, there's a few little steps of this missing because Dermot O'Hagerty writes back on behalf of Michael Collins, says, "Oh well, our hope is that the Four Courts people will disintegrate on their own because they're split up and so on." But like a couple of days later, you know, there's a couple of other things that happen. There's arrest of Leo Anderson, the arrest of Ginger O'Connell in response. But basically, it is. You know, basically, the British say we're going to do it. The treaty is over. You know, the game's up unless you act. You know. And they order MacReady to do it, and he doesn't do it.
He orders to MacReady, and MacReady delays because he doesn't want to.
Right, because MacReady is the opposite of Wilson. He's the anti-Wilson, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So
the one thing the British do not do is attack the Four Courts. They faint. They issue orders. MacReady disobeys the orders. Extraordinary. Goes back to them. I don't think he's disobeying orders at all. I think he's been instructed in London. Go back there, faint and attack, and then abandon it. You know, put pressure on that kind of way. That seems to be a reasonable synopsis. What's going on here is that the pressure is mounting. The British do want that situation solved, but so does Collins. But Collins cannot be seen to act in reaction to British force. So he needs a narrative which will justify the attack on the Four Courts.
I'm not so sure about that, John.
He needs a narrative, and the narrative he creates is this. When there's the raid on Ferguson's garage in Baggot Street, he breaks the joint Northern policy. The cars have been taken in relation to that. And he sends his man, Frank Thornton, Brace Price, get the order, to arrest Leo Henderson. It's Collins that initiates that crisis, and he knows the anti-treatyites will make a reprisal. The reprisal is the kidnapping of Ginger O'Connell, and the war begins. But the way that narrative works in the media, in the newspapers, and on Pathé News, is the issue that provokes the war is the kidnapping of O'Connell. It's the arrest of Leo Henderson that precipitates the crisis, and Collins had full control over that. He abandons the joint Northern policy. He's probably doing that with the introduction of martial law, which means that if not announced, never announced, but quietly, it means that no other law matters except that he will, from there on in, assert his military authority.
I mean, that's the sequence of it. Just very briefly, tell me. That's the sequence of events, absolutely. That's what happened. But, like, I'm not so sure it's Al Collins' plan. As far as I'm aware, Griffith is the one who wants military action all the way along against the Four Courts. And Griffith finally gets it over the line because of these sequence of events.
Griffith does do the military.
That's true, but he's the cabinet. The cabinet is still in control at this point. There's a cabinet meeting the night before the Four Courts. That's my view, you know. I know this is not your view, John.
And do you think the cabinet ordered the shelling of the Four Courts?
I think it's a cabinet decision, yes.
And where's the documentation for that?
There's none, it's all destroyed. Or it's not there.
Where's it destroyed?
It's 32, probably. You know?
There's cabinet minutes.
There's cabinet minutes, but there's bits are missing.
Tell you what, guys, you have to
this
talk this one out afterwards, right?
Yeah, this is
no, I would advise the audience get in quick here, before this takes off. Any questions from the audience here, right? Or
can I just make a comment?
I tell you what, I'll get somebody else in. Right?
Can I just make a comment?
I do appreciate it.
Can I just make a comment while the microphone's going down? So the centenary of this is happening next week, okay? We're talking about it here in Cork. It'll be talked about here in Ireland. It will probably not be talked about in London. So if you look at the centenary of Bloody Sunday, There was no mention of the deaths of those British officers killed. I went and I looked at the Telegraph, the Mail, all the Tory papers, no mention of it. A royal dog called Ludo had died, and the British royal family were very upset, and there was talk about that, but nothing about the men who had sacrificed. And if you go to London, go to 36 Eaton Place, and there are blue plaques everywhere. This theatre director lived here, that emissary lived there. There is none for Henry Wilson. This is a field marshal of the British Empire. He's buried in St. Paul's in the crypt next to Nelson's state funeral. And if you go to Liverpool Street Station, you see this massive plaque to the First World War. Beside it is a tiny bronze plaque, and it says, in memory of Sir Henry Wilson, who died 2 hours after unveiling this memorial. Died. That's the official narrative. Now, there was a second plaque at his house, now missing. The actual steps he went up are gone. They're from, I think, the Brunswick side entrance. But his wife, Cecilia, when British politicians came to the door that afternoon to sympathise, she shouted at them all, murderers, because she believed that they had taken away the police protection that was needed and they had sold out the traitors. She shared Henry's politics. She had painted on the bottom of that wooden door, and there used to be bullet holes in the door, which she left there, that you could see. She had painted in the bottom of the store, quote, on this stone, because it was the last panel down to the stone steps, on this stone died Sir Henry Wilson, assassinated on the door of his house. And that plaque is gone. When that entrance was bricked up, that plaque was taken away. It's in the Imperial War Museum. There's no blue plaque there. And in line with the British government's policy, set out in April of 2019 by Theresa May's Conservative government, the British will have no centenary events for the Amritsar massacre, for the Black and Tans, for anything like that.
Felix, you want a question there?
Well, in confirmation of what Patrick has been saying, it is the habit when an MP is assassinated that a plaque is erected in the House of Commons, and there's one for Joe Cox and one for Sir David Amos. There is none for Henry Wilson. But I think I read in a newspaper that they are planning to erect one, very retrospectively, obviously, this week.
Will that be in the House of Commons, will it be on 36 Eaton
No,
Place?
It's the House of Commons.
So practically no one will see it.
Practically,
and I shouldn't be the person agitating for the commemoration.
No.
I'm just pointing out the hypocrisy.
No, but the significant thing is that he 100 years after his death, there hasn't been one until now. Whereas somebody like Joe Cox and David Amos gets it straight away.
Yeah, and the house was sitting when news of his murder broke, and there was consternation and rumor coming in and partial bits of information, and MPs and lords were asking ministers to sketch in the detail of what they knew. And you're quite right that his widow was absolutely furious with the government, and they weren't actually sure how the funeral would go, whether she would allow members of the government to be present. But in the end, it was the state funeral, one of the largest London had ever seen at that point.
Do you want to ask a question?
We should say as well that Dunn and O'Sullivan are hanged. They're found guilty. We should mention what happened there.
And we should also say that the day after they're hanged, Wilson's ancestral home in Curry Grain, County Longford, is burned down by the IRA.
Just to go back to what the two Johns were saying, and maybe hear more from the other panel, who exactly was calling the shots in Dublin? Was it Griffith or Collins?
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think John and me were different on this. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. That's fine. But like my experience is looking at Richard Mulcahy papers, which has the Free State Cabinet minutes, or the Provisional Government, rather, Cabinet minutes. There's Cabinet minutes before the Four Courts crisis. There's Cabinet minutes afterwards. The ones in the middle are not there, right? Whether Mulcahy took them out, I don't know. Whether they exist anywhere else, I don't know. The information that we have, the third hand kind of what people said afterwards, is there's a cabinet meeting the night before. Now, Griffith, since March, had wanted to move against the anti-treaty IRA. Yep. And his position is that, we have a lawful government now in Ireland, a provisional government. Griffith was never a Republican by ideology. We should be acting against him. And Collins is he's the Republican conspirator. He's trying to get around it in all kinds of ways. He just tried to use the IRB and those kind of back channel things to get them all back together. My reading of the situation is Collins wants to do some sort of deal to get the Four Courts people back on side, whether it's to do with the North or something, whatever it is. And Griffith comes out on top at this moment when there's intense pressure from the British, is my reading. Now, John doesn't agree with that, and that's fine. I think there's room for disagreement, though, because we don't have all of the the materials that we'd like to really establish it.
Like the British, British government not dealing with Griffith, they were only dealing with Collins.
Yeah, Collins. Well, it's a funny thing, actually, because Collins is the head of the provisional government, right, the handover government. But Griffith is the president of the Dáil. You know, there's this funny kind of...
Do
you recognise
the
Dáil? No, but...
But there's this whole issue of a fracture of authority, because the treaty is actually ratified by the Southern Irish Parliament, not by the Dáil.
Right, yeah, technically. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You know,
the army is autonomous from... There are three governments. There's the provisional government, which is created by the treaty and statute of Westminster. The IRA do not recognise that. There's the Dáil government, which has taken responsibility for the IRA in the past. But the IRA itself, both factions are autonomous. And then there's the IRB government as well, which is sometimes forgotten. So if we fast forward to the 12th of July, when Collins becomes Commander-in-Chief and creates an army council, he does that independent of the government, and then writes to Griffith and says, could you give us a proclamation endorsing this? And the proclamation appears on the 14th.
Yeah.
So Collins has created himself as Commander-in-Chief and the Army Council without any reference to any government.
You're wandering into the next hedge school or two down the way, right? We don't fire off every round like in this meeting here.
Just very briefly though on that. Like, I mean, you know, John has done a lot of work in this. He's really brought us on an understanding of this time and all the chaos and stuff that goes on. You know, because Collins is killed when he's killed, like, we don't know what would have happened, right? But there's a lot of possibilities, and we just don't know what would have happened, whether civilian government or military government would have come out on top, you know.
As historians, I'm shocked that you don't know who ordered.
Sorry.
I have a very precise answer for you if you want. I'll answer two of the great questions, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Who shot Henry Wilson, right? It's very clearly Thomas Shelby, if you look at the latest, the first series of Peaky Blinders, right? And if you want to know who shot Michael Collins, it's Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. The film footage is very clear.
Slightly more serious one, right? I read somewhere that when he was being assassinated on the steps, he was in his ceremonial uniform, and he made an attempt to pull his saber out to defend himself. There was no mention of that.
Yeah,
is that true? Is it rubbish?
That's a nice detail that was, you know, that was invented to add color to the story. I think when he fell, his sword fell out of his scabbard. But that became part of the legend of this dastardly assassination.
Can I just throw in gentlemen here?
I'm just curious whether there's any evidence that the publication of the Constitution on the 16th had any bearing on the killing.
I mean, it had a bearing.
You've stumped the panel.
No, it had a bearing. If I can, it had a bearing on the political situation. So, like I said, there's a difference between the Four Courts position and the Liam Lynch position. They're two parts of the anti-treaty IRA. And Lynch's position is, you have this pact in May. You go along with Collins. You have a constitution that doesn't mention the British monarchy, and that's enough to reunite them, the two factions. The Four Courts position is this extremist position of provoke the British back into a reaction. The constitution thing. Which, like, the British insisted there had to be an oath of allegiance and or an oath of fidelity and stuff. There had to be a mention of the monarchy. Exploded the Lynch option, if you like. So did it have a bearing on the assassination of Wilson? Not that I can see. It certainly had a bearing on Civil War, though, yeah.
I think that the key thing around the timing of the publication of the Constitution is that both sides, anti-treaty and pro-treaty Sinn Féin, had agreed an election pact. And if I'm correct, that the actual text of the Constitution was not published until like 24 hours before people voted, or the morning of. So people didn't actually get a chance to read it. Now, what's interesting is, Collins had said, as John mentioned, this will have Republican stuff in this, there won't be an oath. They had actually tried to put in, as President Michael D. Higgins mentioned in the History Ireland special issue in his article, that they had actually tried to put in a few quotations from the 1916 proclamation, but the British rejected it, saying it was, quote, too Bolshevik. So most people hadn't actually read it by the time they voted. And I think you have to remember, like, the degree of literacy, and people weren't going out buying copies of the Constitution to take, the Free State Constitution, to take home and read them. I think a lot of the divisions in the Civil War obviously came down to politics. But if you look at splits in the IRA and stuff, it's personality as well.
a lot of people are saying, if it's good enough for Mick Collins, it's good enough for me. Or there's been a feud in an IRA brigade, and in Clare, like, the Brennans and the Barretts hated each other and spent more time arguing with each other than they did fighting with the British, even though Clare has a very good war record. So it was local things like that, as well as serious political issues, that caused splits. And I don't think that I think that's the main impact of the timing of the Constitution. I don't think it bears, I'm not aware of it having any bearing on Wilson and the Four Courts.
Can I just throw in this is a final question, right? Okay, because I asked you earlier, did the assassination trigger the Civil War? And the answer is yes, right? But if it hadn't happened, would the Civil War have happened anyway? Would there have been another trigger?
Yes.
Maybe.
John Regan?
You see, you're assuming that the answer is yes.
No, I'm assuming nothing. I just asked the question.
So, look, at the end of the day, the Treatyite position at some point was going to have to face down the opposition. And the question then became when. The longer Collins left that on the burner, the back burner, the stronger his position would become. At the beginning of the Civil War, the IRA had all the advantages in terms of men, experience, weapons, but they just messed it up left, right and centre. They didn't have the drive, the focus or the leadership of Collins. So at some point, he was going to have to attack. Wilson's assassination, the one thing the British desperately, 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 desperately don't want to do is come back in. Not because, not alone because they don't want to have to fight the war we've described, the war of conquest, on the scale of the Boer War, but because of the ramifications. This is not an Irish settlement. This is an empire settlement. They have to get this right. They're such a gamble. They're creating a new empire, the Commonwealth, and they have to get it right, and they're desperate not to. And I think Collins plays on that card. I think he sees that.
I think it's inevitable that there was going to be civil war for two reasons. Ideologically, from 1917, when kind of the Republicans coalesce and take over Sinn Féin and everything, it's always get the Brits out. What about socialism? Well, we'll get the Brits out. We'll worry about that then. What about should we have a dual monarchy or should we have his Arthur Griffith? Can he be involved? Look, we'll just get the Brits out. We'll get a republic and everything will be fine. We'll sort it all then. What about class battle? We'll get sorted out then. We'll sort it out then. So it was kind of all different strands of Irish politics, left and right, coalescing on the national issue, and they were guaranteed split against. That's the ideological reason. But militarily, as John said, the IRA, anti-treaty IRA, started with the advantage. And this goes to Jerry's question of who's calling the shots. In March and April of 1922, the Civil War almost begins in Limerick. And Arthur Griffith is mad. He's saying, if we don't go and take back Limerick, which the anti-treaty IRA controlled the barracks, he said, we will be the greatest poltroons in history. I have no idea what a poltroon is, but I assume it's negative. But Richard Mulcahy and Collins pulled him back because, as John said, they're holding. They're saying, we're not ready to fight yet. Fighting breaks out in Kilkenny. There's actually 2 days of shooting in Kilkenny, and eventually a peace agreement is signed. And you have anti-treaty and pro-treaty IRA leaders coming together and agreeing these things. But it was inevitable. It was going to happen some stage. You have huge bodies of armed men on both sides. Shooting was going to happen.
I think I'm just looking at the clock. I think we're beaten with the clock. I'm going to wrap things up here, right? And we still haven't answered the question, who ordered the assassination? Sorry about that, right? Who ordered the assassination Sir Henry Wilson? Listen, I'd like to thank our panel here today, John Dorney, Caoimhín MacDonald, Padraig O'Rourke, John Regan. I'd like to thank you, the audience, particularly those people who contributed from the floor. Our next History Ireland Head School will be on the life and times of Harry Boland, and Ty Crowley is here, will be on the panel. That will take place in Glasnevin Cemetery Museum on Monday, the 1st of August at 2 p.m. Now, if you can't get along, that will be recorded and that will be up as a podcast as well, as will this one. Thank you very much, people, for your attention. Thank you.